Solitaire Rose Radio, episode 45, The Jack Kirby Chronicles, commentary on Fantastic Four, number 51, This Man, This Monster. When I started this solo podcast, I knew a few things I wanted to do. I wanted to interview people that I knew or interview people who had interesting stories, but I also wanted to talk about Jack Kirby. I wanted to talk about EC Comics. And while things have shifted over the few years that I've done this, the core of wanting to tell stories and talking about Jack Kirby has never gone away. Jack Kirby, to my mind, is the most influential comic book artist ever. Will Eisner brought a lot to the table. Harvey Kurtzman brought a lot to the table. Siegel and Schuster with Superman number one. But Jack Kirby, there's really no way to put into words how influential and important he was to comics. And while I'm telling the story of his life in the kind of the Kirby biography podcasts I'm doing, I also decided I want to do more where we talk about what makes Kirby important, what makes Kirby's art so great. Because you can read it and enjoy it and like it, but artists will talk more in detail about the choices he makes, how he draws things. You look at the detail to see just what he brings. Because for a lot of comics, and I hear this all the time now from people who, I don't want to buy a comic. You know, it's $4 and I read it in 10 minutes. Well, then you're missing. You're missing things. Because you have to look at the art. The art, you know, and an artist will take 2 or 3 days on a page, and if you're just buzzing through it in, you know, 30 seconds, 40 seconds, you're not picking up on all the detail and all the work and all that they do. And I'm not an artist, I'm a writer. So I can tell you what I see, but an artist has the eye because they do it. They know the tricks because they've picked up on them, they've used them, or they're learning them. Mark Wise is an artist who, a year ago, I didn't know. He does a podcast with my dear friend, Jin Wicked, who kind of has come into Crazy Comics and Stories. And I also want to talk a little bit about the fact that a year ago is when I interviewed her. And going up to that interview, the podcast, for me, during that year, had shifted from kind of a hobby to something I was very dedicated to. We were moving to episode 200. The solo podcast, in my mind, was becoming more of what it is now. But the other thing about podcasting, when I think back to the early days of comic book podcasting, it was very interconnected. There was Comic Geek Speak, and then the people who were on the message board for Comic Geek Speak would have their own podcast, and then they would be showing up on each other's podcast, and it was very intermingled and intermixed. And over the years, because we're 10 years now into comic book podcasting, to my mind, things have kind of broken apart. I want to kind of start getting back to that idea of we're all in this together. We're all comic book fans, we're all doing stuff. So I like the fact that I'm starting to make connections to these other comic book podcasts. And hopefully, as time goes on, we'll get that interconnectedness back, that sense of community. Because one of the things about podcasting is, much like radio, when done right, you can connect very very easily to it. Because it's just you and the hosts. You're listening to it. It's not like you get together with 30 of your friends to listen to the radio show. Nope, you listen to it. Most people on headphones or in their car or while they're at work. And if we're interconnecting, we're learning from each other and we're all getting better. So as Jin started her podcast, Comic Bros, I listened to it, and I've reached out to both of the other hosts, and Mark Wise and I were talking Kirby, and I said, you know what? Why don't you come on, and we'll talk about a specific Kirby episode? And I sent him the episode I did a while back with Patrick McAvoy, where we went over the New Gods issue, the Glory Boat. And I said, I want to do the same thing, except I want to do it for Fantastic Four number 51. So we got together, and we talked about it. And Mark brings a lot to the table. He knows more than me about how to lay out pages, of course, because he's an artist. Mark brings a lot to the table because he's an active artist. And he's a Kirby fan. And we talked a little bit about his influences and where he started reading comics and how he got into it. So I really hope you enjoy this episode where we go through Fantastic Four number 51 page by page. If you have a copy, go ahead and grab it. Follow along with us. On the YouTube version, I will be having the pages there. They won't go at the exact timing of our discussion of it because we do move back and forth. And let's face it, I'm not that bright, so I haven't learned how to exactly do that yet on the YouTubes. But we do have that, and just follow along with the story so that you can see what we're talking about. Treat this like your DVD commentary of Fantastic Four number 51, which is available in the Marvel Masterworks Fantastic Four volume 5, or the Fantastic Four Essential number 2, or on the DVD that came out a few years ago, 44 Years of the Fantastic Four, or there are illicit ways you can get it. It's also available on Marvel Unlimited, so there's a lot of ways for you to follow along. And now, here's our discussion. Well, I was going to ask, what was your introduction to Jack?
My introduction to Jack Kirby was actually Fantastic Four. In the Marvel Masterworks collections. I grew up, I was a child of the 80s and 90s, so I was a big comics fan right in the middle of the whole 90s, you know, everything.
Oh, yeah.
So
when you were younger, who was the artist you looked at and said, I want to draw like that?
Todd McFarlane, actually.
Yep. It's funny how, to me, because I was in my 20s when the Image thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually working in comics retail as it started and blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And older fans were like, I can't believe people like this Rob Liefeld shit. And McFarlane had worked in mainstream comics and it had editors sit on him long enough that he was able to do good storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
But with Liefeld, people would go, why do these kids like this crap? And I said, because he draws like they do.
Yep.
And they like that. McFarlane had actual classical art training.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at his stuff on Infinity Incorporated, even though it was inked by Tony DeZungia, who should just – he's good on some people, but, man, he just buried McFarlane.
Yeah.
McFarlane had these – beautiful page layouts.
Well, what's funny about those page layouts is actually McFarlane felt like he couldn't draw figures properly. And so he actually started doing those page layouts and designing the page to try to cover up for what he felt like his inadequacies for figure drawing was, so.
And that's probably why they put Tony DeZungia on it, because DeZungia was the artist who worked with Buscema and a lot of the Filipino artists.
Mm-hmm.
if you've ever seen John Buscema roughs,
yeah,
they would call them thumbnail sketches now. That's how he was able to do 3 books a month, and one of them was Savage Sword of Conan, which was usually he would do a 40 to 50 page story.
Mm-hmm.
So DeZungia was very good at making, kind of bringing the anatomy in.
Mm-hmm.
So McFarlane, who was very influenced by Ditko, in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely.
And a lot of the Image boys except for Liefeld, worshipped Kirby.
Yeah, and that's actually what I was going to get to. So, you know, I got into all the Image stuff, and I picked up Spawn number one, and I open it up, and right there on the first, on the inside cover, McFarlane says, dedicated to Jack Kirby. And so the name Jack Kirby just keeps popping up more and more and more, and so I'm like, okay, I if I'm serious about comics, I gotta look into this. And so, you know, I started with the Fantastic Four.
Which book?
Actually right at the beginning.
Okay.
And I got the first Marvel Masterworks, and then after that I skipped to volume 5, which is the introduction to the Inhumans and Silver Surfer and Galactus, where Kirby really starts becoming Kirby. I can say that now in hindsight, but...
Now, for me, the Fantastic Four number one is really like Kirby's 50s work, where it's kind of crude with a lot of... He was still kind of shaking off the influence of DC because mm-hmm. DC made him tone everything down.
Mm-hmm.
So that Fantastic Four number one, it almost looks like a golden age book in some ways, as Kirby was kind of coming back to the more dynamic style that he'd had before he was at DC.
Right.
But with Fantastic Four, I always say that 38 and 39 is where the Fantastic Four became the book we know.
Yeah.
With that Doctor Doom, Daredevil, and then the Frightful Four.
Mm-hmm.
But also you had Joe Sinnott come in.
Yes. And there's definite...
Sinnott just... Oh.
Yeah, there's a definite change right there. The way Sinnott inks Kirby is just... It's perfect for the book. It's a lot different from, like, the New Gods stuff, where it's a lot rougher and whatnot. And I think that works for New Gods, but the way Sinnott inks for the Fantastic Four, it just really brings out the whole sci-fi element of it. And it's just all slick. It looks like slick sci-fi, what it's supposed to look like. And the Kirby machines, he just has all the perfect little details on Kirby's weird imagined machines.
And he brings almost a sheen to the book. When I've gone back and looked at the original comics, Thor, which was inked by Coletta, I won't, ladies and gentlemen, I will not spend the podcast bashing Vince Coletta like I always do. But those books look more, they look older. They look older, whereas the Fantastic Four with Sinnott's inks, and they did something with the coloring. It looked brighter. It looked modern. Mm-hmm. It had a sheen to it.
It still looks modern.
Yes. It was also around this time that Stan, the Marvel line was starting to expand, and Stan was spending more and more time as editor.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't as hands-on. So Kirby kind of had more say in the story. There's the very famous thing about how when he delivered Fantastic Four 48, Stan looked at it and said, "Who's this silver guy?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can kind of tell that sometimes Stan is kind of having to guess what Kirby's thinking, because sometimes the dialogue doesn't always match up with the picture.
What their style was around this time was that they would do a story conference.
Mm-hmm.
They'd sit and they'd talk, okay, here's what we're going to do in this book. Here's what we're going to do in this book. Because at this time, Kirby was drawing 4 books.
Yeah.
A month. Think about that.
Oh, I know.
He was penciling 4 books a month.
I'm fully aware that he is the most prolific comic artist that ever was and probably ever will be.
No, there was one person faster, and he worked for Marvel in the 50s, and he was different from Kirby, but he was still incredibly good, and I'm still learning about his art, and that's Joe Manili.
Okay.
Joe Manili worked at Timely Atlas during the 50s. The book that's easiest to find for you to see some of his art was, there's a Marvel Masterwork which has the Yellow Claw and the Black Knight. And Manili drew the Black Knight. And he could draw a 7-page story in the office if they were behind.
Yeah.
But Manili died in 1959, which was when Kirby was looking for work. So Stan has said in some of his more serious interviews that if Manili would have lived and Kirby came in, he wouldn't have had to hire anyone to draw books until they finally broke out of the 8 books a month restriction they had. And Manili was faster than Kirby. But if you, they reprint Kirby's pencils in Jack Kirby Collector. These are not thumbnails. These are not sketches. These are not layouts. He did full pencils.
Yeah. I've seen his pencils, and yeah, they are pretty much fully rendered on the page.
But one of the things about Stan as writer, and I tend to get in trouble with some of the more hardcore Kirby fans about this, is Stan was the editor at Marvel, and one of the reasons he was the writer was that the owner, Martin Goodman, was too cheap to allow him to hire writers.
Mm-hmm.
So he did what the editors in comics did in the 60s, which was he would sit down with the creative team and go, all right, this is the story that I want for this month, this is the story that I want for next month, this is this. Kirby would draw it, put notes around the panels and bring it in. Stan would script it, and sometimes he would script what Kirby said, and sometimes he would be the editor and change things.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, there are times in certain Marvel stories where you go, huh, the words don't exactly match the pictures. A lot of that was Stan changing the story because he didn't agree with what the writer, what the artist had done.
Right.
And as editor, that's what he did. Now, we're going to be talking about Fantastic Four number 51. And I want to give, I'll set up the historical for it. This was right after the Galactus trilogy.
And Lee and Kirby were on fire at this point.
And the Fantastic Four was still outselling Spider-Man. This issue came out as Ditko had either just left Marvel or was leaving Marvel. Fantastic Four was their number one selling book, and it was just exploding with creativity as well as with sales. But Marvel was going through a shift in that Ditko had left, other artists were kind of pulling back, and he was bringing in new artists. So there's kind of this feeling of Kirby saying, oh crap, they're bringing in new artists. I need to step up my game. And Kirby stepping up his game in a lot of ways is when Marvel really exploded. You had two cartoon shows going. And this company had only been around 5.5 years really doing superheroes. They had the shitty Marvel Superheroes cartoon, which where they actually took drawings from the comics and would just move them across the screen and stuff. But there was a Fantastic Four cartoon in the works and a Spider-Man cartoon in the works.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when we come into This Man, This Monster. Kirby's style at the time, when we think the Galactus trilogy, we think that's what the story was. But really, the first issue of the Galactus trilogy wrapped up the Inhuman stuff. And the last half of the 50th issue led into this stuff with Johnny Storm in college.
Mm-hmm.
And where we had left off story-wise was the Thing had seen Alicia with the Silver Surfer. And because Stan liked the melodrama, it's, oh, she likes him because he's pretty and I'm a monster. And the last thing we see is him storming off. And you wanted to talk about the cover.
I do, but I can save that for later because a lot of what I, you know, want to talk about with the cover because this is such an iconic cover, it does tie into the story and whatnot. Well, maybe I can talk about it without spoiling the story.
Well, this is, if you have not read the story, you shouldn't be listening to a DVD commentary of it.
Fair enough. But
another thing to remember is that back now, when you look at a comic book cover, it's more like a poster. Back then, the cover is what sold the book.
Well, and the cover should still be what sells the book. Cover artists these days, it's terrible. The cover, this is the perfect example of a comic book cover. It is a brilliant illustration that not only depicts an actual scene from the story, but it also touches on all of the elements in the story. You have the Thing standing front and center with his, you know, conflict of, you know, what am I, which everybody who's been reading Fantastic Four is familiar with, because there's been the whole Ben Grimm hating his monster self. But at the same time, he can't get rid of being the Thing because he's a hero when he's a Thing. He's more than he was before. And you have Reed behind him, an obvious danger. Something's going on. He's disintegrating, and Sue is pleading with Thing for help. And he's just immobilized there. And, you know, with the caption, "This man, this monster," it just basically, it tells you the entire story in the comic right there. And beyond that, it's just a perfect image too.
It's upfront, and the thing that I like about it is there is so much emotion.
Yes.
When you think Kirby, you think bombastic action. Most people forget how good he was at using body language and exaggerated body language to convey emotion. All of the emotion you need without – this was before Marvel started putting word balloons on everything. Mm-hmm. You know what's happening just from looking at their body language.
Yeah, and there are some – there are some key points in the book, and I'll talk about them when we get to them, where I just noticed the body language that Kirby was drawing was just perfect. And, you know, it didn't even need any dialogue or anything. You could tell exactly what was going on.
The other thing about this cover, and I want to give a little anecdote. In the 70s, Stan Lee was detached from Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Because his job had changed. He'd gone from editor-in-chief to publisher. And he was kind of told by the new owners, "We really want you to do what you can to sell our properties out in Hollywood." So he would be in New York, but he would also be touring colleges and going to conventions and meeting with people out in L.A. to try and sell stuff. And there was a point in the 70s where he looked at a cover and he said, "We never put green on the covers. Don't put green on the covers. Green doesn't sell. We've never done green covers." If you take a look at this cover, because of the way it's colored, the green is what pops.
Yeah. Which actually is perfect for the color. I mean, because orange and green are complementary colors.
Yes.
So that's why it works so well with Reed being in the green and the text of "This man, this monster" being in the green, because it's a perfect contrast to the orange of Thing just standing right up there in the middle. You really couldn't have a better color to make this image really pop, with the Thing being as front and center as he is.
Now, when you go to the first page, I often say this is the most iconic first page of the Silver Age at Marvel. It's the Thing standing in the rain. Kirby uses facial expression, and the background is very much behind because of the rain, but the way he he has the thing in the rain. Everything you need to know about this character is right there.
That's right, and it sets the mood. You have Thing, again, like you pointed out earlier, last we saw Thing, he was wandering off, his heart broken because, you know, his girlfriend was in love with the perfect-looking alien. And so he's wandering off, he's in the rain, and it just sets the mood perfectly.
And it's one of those things where if you're a kid and you open up and you see that, normally Kirby on his splash page would have the Fantastic Four demonstrating their powers. Reed would be stretching, the Human Torch would be using his fire on something, the Thing would be ready to smash something, Sue would be trying to stop them. This is very different. And it just, as a Fantastic Four fan, you'd probably open it up and go, oh, wow. The other thing is, you're just getting done with this huge cosmic story of the Earth in imminent danger. And these huge cosmic beings, where the Fantastic Four are just kind of gnats flying around them. We're going to go to an essentially human story.
Yeah, I mean, because after you have the crazy story that was the Galactus story, you need to come back and take a breath. I mean, you can't just have, oh, the world's ending. Now the world's ending again. Now the world's ending again. No, you have to step back and take a breath. And this splash page effectively says, okay, all right, we're coming down. You know, we know the world. We just saved the world. So let's all just sit back. You know, let's take a breath here. This is going to be a more low-key story.
And it's very different from modern comics, who are scared to do this now, because without huge continuity, bending, whatever, they're scared the audience will wander off. Which is strange to me, because one of the best comics of the last 10 years has been Hawkeye, which was all low-key human stories.
Mm-hmm.
But they still feel like, oh, we're not just going to end the Marvel universe, we're ending every universe.
Yeah, where it all started with Crisis on Infinite Earths. I could definitely be happy if I never saw a gigantic universe ending. You gotta buy every 50 comic in our line to get the whole story.
The problem with that is, and I say it every time, you'll get the online fans who go, this is stupid, I'm not buying it, I don't want... They sell.
No, I know they do, I know they do. I'm probably the only person who's... Well, no, I'm not the only person, but we're definitely in the minority of all the people like, I've seen those. The universe came back. Okay. Moving on.
Moving on to page 2. One of the things that I like about Stan was incredibly verbose. And through this story, he's unbelievably verbose. But there were times when he would just let the art tell the story. The opening narration is, occasionally a tale needs no introduction. This is such a tale. A rainy night, a strangely forlorn figure, a rare wonderment awaits us. Stan was very hyperbolic, but he's saying, look, this is all you need. And as we go through the story, this is all you need. The Thing is wandering the streets, heartbroken and forlorn, and we start with another panel showing that. There's nobody on the street. There's a cop car, but there are no other people on the streets of New York. The Thing just kind of walking in the middle of the street, mm-hmm. not caring what's going on.
Yeah, and again, this establishes Thing as very isolated and, you know, just lonely. And the cops come up and they try to be nice to him, but, you know, he's not having any of it because, you know, that's the way most people are when they've just had their heart broken. People try to be nice to you, but, you know, you're not having any of it. Sometimes you just want to wallow, and that's where the thing is right here.
And if you notice, Kirby doesn't show the faces of the cops.
Mm-hmm.
That camera's pulled back, the faces are both turned. He's showing that isolation in the art.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the thing is just wandering, this is something that as a writer I would never do, but for Kirby it works. He just kind of wanders to where this scientist is. And again, on this page, third panel, we're introducing this new character. We don't see his face.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, fourth panel. We don't see his face. Fifth panel, he's completely in shadow.
And I love that fifth panel because without a single word here, Kirby is saying, this is the villain.
Yes.
You know, he's acting nice in the first panel. You know, you see the hands. It looks like it could be somebody who's trying to help out. But when you get to the fifth panel and he's just there in shadow, he's like, okay, this is the bad guy of the piece.
And the other thing I love about this panel, the thing is not a character that's easy to draw facial expressions on. Because he's very stylized and rocks.
Mm-hmm.
But you get this look of on Ben Grimm's face of just kind of anger. He's gone from isolation to now anger. And then in the next panel, it's back to real depression.
Yeah, and a lot of the tricks that Kirby uses to show Ben being angry here and shifting back and forth between anger and, you know, depression is you'll notice in that panel where we were just talking about where they introduce the villain and he's all in shadow and you get the angry thing right up front. There's no pupil in Thing's eye.
Right.
But whenever you see him more vulnerable and more, depressed, you see that little pupil that's in the eye, and that element right there just helps to completely humanize the facial expressions right there.
The other thing from a layout perspective is if you look at all the panels on the left side of the page, the thing is moving to the right.
Mm-hmm.
That's Kirby's way of kind of drawing your eye across the page. You know, we always read left to right, but Kirby would guide you along that way, and that was his way of kind of making the story more dynamic, to move you there.
There's actually a great example of that later in this story. It's on page 18, and I'll talk about it when we get there.
All right. Now, on page 2, Kirby uses a very standard 9-panel grid, which he did not use often. Ditko loved the 9-panel grid. Kirby, especially as we get later in the Fantastic Four, is around like the 4-panel page.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a 9-panel grid that moves the story. And it's not till you read it a second or third time where you go, oh, that's really a cliche. Where it's, oh, here's a drink. It's drugged. Here, come on.
Yeah.
You don't know me. Here, have some coffee. It's drugged.
No, you're right. Kirby normally does just the smallest he likes to generally go down to is the 6 panels or, you know, the 4 panels. He doesn't usually go up to the 9 panels, but the pacing of the story right here is what dictates that. It's a conversation, so you don't have a lot of bombastic movements that you need to convey. So, you know, you need to take the opportunity to get your story in. But, you know, the 9 panels just break up the pacing in a good way that it just makes the conversation feel natural and flow naturally between these two.
And again, using the body language on the thing, he's hunched over, his head is down. It's the sad Charlie Brown pose almost in all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes you along and give Stan a chance to go, okay, here's this guy's backstory. Here's why he's the antagonist of the piece. Kind of, okay, here's our info dump.
Exactly.
And it also goes to one of the things Stan brought to it is your antagonist needs to have a reason why they're an antagonist rather than, you know, they're Lex Luthor. Ah, I hate you, Superman, because you made me bald.
Mm-hmm.
he would give motivation.
Wait a minute, this is Lex Luthor?
No, he
could be. He's never named.
He is never named, which is always fascinating to me. I'm amazed no one has brought this character back because, good Lord, Marvel's brought everybody back.
Well, you know why he's not named? Because for all intents and purposes, he is the Thing in this story.
Yes.
And that's why he doesn't have a name, because here's my thing about this story is this is obviously a story about Thing, and it's about things. It's about Ben Grimm's conflict between being Ben Grimm and being the Thing. And because this is serialized fiction, if you want to do a story where Thing learns, hey, you know, I am Ben Grimm, or Ben Grimm learns, I am the Thing, we're one and the same, it's me that's the hero, I'm not a monster, I'm a man. And if you want to have him learn that lesson, you can't actually have Ben Grimm learn that lesson, because you have to, you know, have him forever being this is what Thing does. He
yes.
grapples with his humanity. So you bring in a Thing analog to learn this lesson, and then in the end of it, you know, you can have Ben Grimm having the same struggles that he's always had, even though you got this story out where, you know, the Thing does explore, am I a man? Am I a monster? What am I?
And we've also hit the point in Silver Age Marvel where Stan realized that they were going to last. So rather than the big changes he was doing along the way during the first 3 to 4 years, we've now hit the illusion of change.
Mm-hmm.
Where, okay, the Thing can leave the Fantastic Four, but he will eventually come back. Dr. Doom will be defeated, but eventually he will come back. And in this, the Thing, you can't cure the Thing, because then if you do, you've changed the dynamic and you have to bring in new characters. But we can toy with the idea of what would Ben Grimm be like if he wasn't the Thing.
That's right.
Moving to the next page, we start the panel where this is one of the reasons I adore Jack Kirby. This is just, it's some random apartment, open a closet door, oh, look, it's Kirby machinery.
Yes. This was my spare bedroom, but I took it up. I had to get a 2-bedroom. It was worth the price because I had to have somewhere to put my machine.
And Kirby's machine design, it's futuristic and 50s at the same time.
It's also very organic.
Yes.
You have all the curves and the tubes making it very soft and very organic at the same time, which helps it feel very alien.
And to this day, I wish I could know where he sort of pulled this stuff from, because Kirby was a sponge. So, you know, he had to kind of get the idea from somewhere for how he would design the machines.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot for the life of me find where he sort of picked it from. So you have to almost assume that that's how he thought Machines of the Future would look.
Oh, clearly. I mean, Kirby was nothing if not imaginative.
Yes. And
so, yeah, I'm sure he was thinking this is what machines would look like. His, to me, and I could be wrong, his machine design always did have kind of ancient feel to it. If you look back at, like, I want to say ancient Aztec art.
Yes.
And
when you get to the Eternals,
mm-hmm.
he just lets that that influence go wild.
Yeah, but I mean, you can see it in the machines, and I think that's where a lot of the organic flow is coming from. And I think, again, that's the mixing of the ancient plus the imagined future is what really makes it so unique.
And the bottom three panels shows this nameless scientist becoming the thing. And again, Kirby uses the facial expressions almost in opposition to what Stan's writing, in that he shows the agony that you go through to become this, sort of reminding us that, yes, the thing is becoming our cuddly Bronx teddy bear, but he's in pain, inside and outside, because his skin is now rocks.
Yeah, and the other thing I love about these bottom three panels is they're a callback to the very early issues of Fantastic Four, where you did just randomly have Thing change into Ben Grimm and then change back. And there never seemed to be any rhyme or reason to it. But as refined as Kirby has gotten with his design on Thing now, this transformation is still almost exactly panel for panel what it was in some of the early issues.
When we get to page 5, flipping over here, I have this on my 44 years of the Fantastic Four DVD, because good Lord, I can't keep every comic that I would like in regular form. My house is already full.
Yeah, I'm getting that way.
The top panel shows that the transformation is complete. We then move to the Baxter Building, where Reed Richards is creating something because he is now obsessed with defending the Earth against huge cosmic menaces. And it's one of the cliches of Stan 60's work. Reed is obsessed. Sue is worried.
Yeah. Reed and Sue have the most dysfunctional marriage ever.
Oh, no. No, 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 no. Ant-Man and the Wasp.
All right, fair enough. But they're not Marvel's first family.
No.
The Fantastic Four is, and the precedent is set there that superheroes and marriage don't go well together.
Although they've stayed married since 65.
That's true, but sometimes you wonder how.
Well, later writers have come along to kind of work that and sort of fix this. But this was very 60s.
No, it was. And that's why I'm sitting here just kind of laughing about it. I mean, because I go back and I read all these issues, early issues of Fantastic Four, and you just have to acknowledge that it's a completely different time.
Yes. And Sue, oh, I don't know if I the readers don't seem to like me. Oh. Sue had all the personality of a wet dish rag.
Yeah.
Which is why when Kirby went to DC, I absolutely loved Big Barda with all of my heart and soul, because she was like the opposite of every whiny, love-struck Marvel female in that. When you read Mr. Miracle, she's the one in charge, God damn it. And Scott Free's like, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I'm just doing my stuff here.
I do finally have the first two omnibus, Fourth World omnibus volumes. I'm looking forward to reading them.
Oh, they're such fun.
They're on my pile, my way too large pile of things I need to read.
I don't even talk about that pile. But the one panel to me that really jumped out was panel 5, which is Reed's face as he's explaining, we've got to do this or we're all going to die.
Yeah, I actually had that in my notes. I said something about, man, Reed is pissed.
And in a lot of ways, this was a personality thing that they just drop in every once in a while. But later on, future writers really picked up on this, where they're explorers, but he's obsessed with protecting the Earth.
Well, and the funny part is, too, is clearly he's – I know why he's so pissed and looking at the artwork, because in panel three – he's okay, you know. He's like, all right, you know, Sue, I'm working. Go away. But she keeps saying, but dear, you need to eat. If you don't eat, you will die. Damn it, woman, I have to do this.
Now, the final panel is where Stan stumbles big time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing imposter speaks exactly like the thing. Well, he's gone from the scientist to, you know, the uncouth Bronx accent.
Well, he actually says up in the panel on the top of this page, he says,
yes, I need to practice speaking like the thing. Hey, but it's like, okay, you've just walked to the Baxter building.
No, he's had a
few. You don't learn these speech patterns on a walking 20 blocks.
Well, he's had a few days. It says a few days later.
Oh, okay.
Now, granted, that's still stretching it, but
it's one of the things when I reread the story, it's like, oh, okay, artistic license, I'll give that.
Okay, well, you know what? In defense of Stan right here, this guy had obviously been planning this for a while. So he could have been working on his accent, you know, all this time. Because he had specifically targeted the thing.
Right.
So.
And the thing just happened to walk by his apartment.
Yeah.
Okay. We give it to him.
It's comics. Come on. You got to stretch.
Well, it's fiction. They do that stuff in fiction. Yeah. The next page, again, if you notice, the last couple pages have been Kirby's six panels. And for all of how we do panel layout now, Kirby stuck to a very standard panel layout while he worked at Marvel. Back in the 40s and 50s, he would do more design work and more panel inserts. But at Marvel, it was very much the standard grids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, that's that influence at DC where they kind of pounded the experimentation out of him, because DC did not allow such things in the 50s.
Right. You know, sometimes, you know, having that standard panel is good because it helps, you know, just flow the story. I mean, there's no question to the reader where you need to look. Sometimes some artists will really go crazy with their designs, and I'm going to pick on Stan Sakai for a second here, because I love Stan Sakai, but occasionally he'll do a layout where he actually puts in arrows that tells you which panel to go to next. And as a designer, I have always felt that if you have to put arrows in to tell your reader which panel to go to next, you have failed at designing that page.
Exactly. Gene Colan, during the 60s, had to do a lot of that. And Stan made him put in the arrows, because Stan would go, I don't know what to read next. You're going to need to let me know.
Mm-hmm.
And while I understand doing that, one of the things Kirby did, if you look at his 40s and 50s work, though, he would change panel sizes, and he would go with circular panels and stuff for emphasis. And he stopped doing that. Now, he does pick it up again in the 70s.
Oh, there are definitely ways to do it, and there are definitely ways to do it well. But I guess my point is, in defense of the six-panel grid or the nine-panel grid, you can tell a very effective story that way.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And as I said, and as you said, if you have to use an arrow, you've failed as a comic storyteller. This page is very much setting up what's going to happen. Ben Grimm returns at the bottom. And he is all action and all motion.
And this is where Kirby, these two pages here, between 6 and 7, this is where a lot of the body language just really comes, tells you not only exactly what is happening, but it tells you exactly who Ben Grimm is and what his character is. Because yes, in the sixth panel, well, even the fifth panel, but in the fifth and sixth panel on page 6, Ben Grimm comes in and he's ready to throw down. And he has to know better than anyone that he, as a normal person, would not stand a chance against the thing. But at the same time, he's ready to throw down to defend Reed and Sue from this imposter.
And the other thing about it is the thing is drawn very static. It's not the dynamic, always in motion thing. If you look at many of the panels, he's just kind of standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And especially on page 7, when he goes to pick up to show his strength, those are not dynamic panels. They're very posed. They're almost stiff in a way.
Yeah, as
and
if,
to me, it shows this is not the thing. This is someone else.
That's right. It seems as if the unnamed scientist is still learning how to move as the thing. And so therefore his movements are very jerky and stiff. In the fifth panel on page 7, this was another moment where it was just the body language on Ben Grimm is perfect, because the three panels you see him before this one on these two pages, he's in action. He's ready to move. He's hunched over. He's leaning forward. He's being aggressive. But in this panel, and it's just a simple shot from behind his back, you can tell he's stood up straight because he's in shock that, you know, nobody believes him.
And the other thing about this panel from a storytelling perspective, in all of the other panels on this page, we are at eye level. In this one, we're not just behind Ben Grimm, but we're up. The camera has come up. And in filmmaking, and Kirby was a huge fan of film, when you go up, you're telling the viewer, you know things these characters don't know. You are, basically, you are God looking down on this situation. You know things they don't. Kirby has pulled up, putting us above the characters. And then the next panel, we're right. It's a close shot, facial body of Ben Grimm in your face yet again. And the dynamic of that shift just kind of really jumps out at you when you read the story.
Mm-hmm. And another thing on these two pages, if I can go back for a second to the thing's movements being stiff and whatnot, the way Kirby draws thing's face on all these pages is also brilliant, because he really nails the facial expressions too of the guy inside thing figuring things out, like the sense of amused wonder when he's picking up that machine Reed asks him to pick up, and just the kind of look on his face when he sees Ben Grimm come in. He's kind of, you can see him kind of calculating and the gears turning.
Yes.
Like, how am I going to deal with this? And again, as we've talked about before, drawing facial expressions on the thing is very difficult, because you have all those stone crags and rocks and cracks and everything. So you can't put the normal wrinkles from somebody's face in to show the normal facial expressions.
Yeah, it's like the final panel on page 7, where he distorts Ben Grimm's face to show that anger.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that with the thing, because his face really can't be distorted. He plays with it, though, in the middle panels on this page, where you don't see the thing's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
you know, normally if the thing's going to do a test of strength, he's, you know, very expressive and outward. And in this, it's more very inward, mm-hmm. almost drawn as if he's closing in on himself.
Right. He doesn't have the bravado. The word, right. The words are there, but the body language and the bravado is not.
The next page is the first page where I went, oh man, Stan, quit covering up the art. Stan goes word crazy here.
Yeah, and I actually don't think a lot of the words match the art on this page. Because in the first couple of panels here, I see, you know, Ben saying, Thing is saying, big deal, he's some phony. Man, I was afraid you guys were going to believe him. But in that second panel, Reed is, you know, stopping Thing from leaving.
Yeah.
So the way I see these top two panels, Thing's initially trying to blow it off, but he's serious thinking, ooh, I really don't want to risk that happening again. I better go take care of Grim.
Yeah.
So.
And then I talk a lot about Sue when I do Fantastic Four stories. Panel four, she looks hysterical, and the words don't match. So you almost wonder what Kirby was going to have for that panel.
Yeah.
Because she looks like she's trying to restrain Reed, and Reed's just, you know, calmly ignoring her. Well, gee, honey, I have to do these scientific experiments again. And again, look at the facial expression on the Thing.
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up.
He's standing there observing, looking depressed.
I don't think he's necessarily looking depressed. I think he's just taking it all in. Because this is a guy who at the beginning of the story said, I hate Reed Richards. I will destroy the Fantastic Four to prove that I'm better than Reed Richards and I'm smarter. And I think he's just kind of stepping back and observing and just seeing how much Reed, Sue, and Ben all care about each other. The incident with Ben coming in obviously shook him up.
Yes.
So he's sitting here thinking, whoa, wait a minute. This guy went into a hopeless situation to defend Reed Richards? What am I missing here? So he's just kind of stepping back and he's just taking it all in. And if you look at Thing in panels 3 through 5, that's all he's doing. He's just standing there observing Reed and Sue the whole time.
And remember, the reason he hated Reed Richards is he's a glory hound. He's out for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, Reed isn't going to get anything out of this other than he's defending the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, we have your typical Kirby. There's some sort of experiment Reed's going to do where we really don't know what and why, but it's important.
Mm-hmm.
And on the next page, you get a huge one.
A cube!
It's a splash page that's just a new Kirby machine that, oh my god, this is so cool.
I love that it's described as a radical cube.
Yes.
Radical fits. I don't know about cube.
Well, there's some cube to it and curbs and other stuff.
I suppose there are a couple straight lines. It's probably three-dimensional.
And the thing is, it almost looks like an M.C. Escher drawing, the way Kirby has put it together. It looks so cool on the page, but then when you think about it, it's, well, how would that look in what?
It is very much something that I don't think could actually be constructed in reality.
No.
Obviously, I'm not talking about the machine, but I'm just talking even the model of it. I'm not sure that this could be reconstructed in reality.
The next page, we're popping into a subplot. And it's about Johnny Storm going back to college. We have introduced the new character Wyatt Wingfoot, who is his Native American friend, who will be involved in stories later on. But Stan and Jack did this a lot where in the middle of the story, it's okay, here's something that will lead to something later on.
Yeah.
And it almost feels very 50s. In a almost an Archie kind of way.
It does, and this is one of the parts of the comic that actually feels dated to me. Because to me, this feels like, oh, we gotta pop in because it's the Fantastic Four. You can't have an issue of Fantastic Four without every single member of the Fantastic Four being in the comic. So we gotta show where Johnny is. And I don't think in modern comics people would worry about saying, oh, look, here's Johnny in college. And I don't know. I don't like these pages. They take me out of the story.
And not only that, they look very different. It's almost as if someone else inked it. The Johnny Storm figures do not look like Kirby drawings to me.
No, they don't for the most part. There are a couple that really do feel like Kirby drawings, like the sixth panel on page 10, but most of the others, it does feel a little weird.
And the other thing about it, Sinnott was very brush-driven. He didn't use a lot of small lines. There are a lot of smaller lines here that, to me, I almost think Stan had someone correct this art,
mm-hmm.
which he would do. And like I said, these pages don't really fit in this story, but it was part of the way Stan and Jack would put things together. And by page 12, we're back to the main story.
Well, before we go back to there, can I just note one weird thing about this interlude too?
Sure.
I don't know if Stan was trying to say something or not, but the Cozy Campus Coffee Shop is all in K's, and and the bully is a guy named Whitey.
I don't know if he was consciously saying that, because one thing about Stan, I think the best way to describe it is they had the Ku Klux Klan in the Marvel Universe, but it was called the Sons of the Serpent.
Yeah, I know, but I don't know. I don't really think there's anything to it, but it just feels kind of weird, especially since, you know, you have a Native American character who's the guy standing up to the bully. Well, not that Johnny's not standing up to him, but
right.
But this little interlude is really not about Johnny. It's about Wyatt.
Right. And it's very much setting up other things later on. The other thing about it to me, and I always go back to, Stan said that his favorite stuff was to write in the 50s, and it was one of the few things he would sign, because he would sign everything he did. But if you look through the 50s stuff, what he liked were the humor books, the Patsy Walker, the Archie knockoffs he did. And going into the Silver Age of Marvel, a lot of the stuff that he strongly plotted had those same sort of soap opera elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think he may have had somebody do some redrawing on this, maybe a different inker. And especially if you go down to on page 12.
Right.
When this strange interlude ends, the art looks completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You're back to Sinnott's ink flow. And it's Sue is begging Reed not to go. Reed is... And if you notice, Reed has not used his powers yet.
Nor does he in this book.
Which, one of the things Kirby would always do, he would always show Reed using his powers just kind of offhandedly to show, oh, these are his powers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he could stretch, so he's going to stretch around and grab a cup of coffee sort of thing.
Right.
But he doesn't use his powers. We're back to the main story.
And I love this pose. I love this bottom panel on page 12. The pose between Reed and Sue, is really, it's very Kirby-esque. It's static yet dynamic at the same time.
Yes.
Reed and Sue feel like they're going to pop off the page, and then Thing back there feels like he's actually anchoring them on the page. You know, as if they actually were going to come flying off the page, if not for Thing standing there with his tether.
And then now we have an example of Kirby Crackle and Kirby's, well, it's a four-panel page. Reed is about to go into the unknown.
And that first panel is a really good example of setting up how everything is going to go in the unknown, because he uses one-point perspective and almost a forced perspective in there to make Reed feel like he's in a space that is simultaneously spacious yet claustrophobic.
And if you notice, he's also tilted the camera.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going dead on. Things are about to get different. We're about to go somewhere else. And just that little change makes it feel a little more alien.
Exactly. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. It just, that little shift makes it feel just a little bit more ill at ease.
And then the next panel is Kirby Crackle,
mm-hmm.
which the coloring really helps it. Normally I complain about coloring that it overwhelms, but whoever colored this, because there is no colorist credited, really did a good job of taking what Kirby did and using that negative space to really pop what Kirby was trying to do here. This is, he's going into another dimension. He's going to another universe. We only get a partial image of Reed in this. And then the next two, Stan writes that it's a four-dimensional universe. It's, to my mind, one of the things Kirby does here, he borrows from Ditko. This feels like very much Ditko's
yes,
Doctor Strange.
Exactly. Feels very Doctor Strange, very unearthly, yet at the same time kind of mystical, and yeah, just trying to be trippy.
Yep. And then page, where is it here?
14.
But yes, page, yeah. 14 is a Kirby collage, which he had started doing, and I know that there are very mixed feelings about when he would do the photo collages in the comics. I enjoy them a lot.
I will actually go on record as saying I hated them. I don't.
And I completely understand why people did not like them.
Except for this one. This one is collage mixed in with the cartooning done well. This page to me does not feel like a splash page in a comic book. This feels like a piece of pop art. This is raising the cartooning to the level of fine art. I feel like this could hang in a gallery right next to anything that Warhol did or any of the other pop artists out there.
And in many ways, the thing that I like about it in this story is this story is about Reed going somewhere else. This feels like we've not been here before. Even though if you look at it from, well, would that be what another dimension looks like? No, it looks different from anything we've seen in this book before. It really shifts us out of that world that we've been in while reading this story.
And it looks entirely different from Reed.
Yes. Nice muted coloring as well.
Mm-hmm.
Reed is very Marvel, boom, solid primary color. This is more muted, more nuanced.
which is further enhanced by the photo collage dulling down any of the colors that are underneath it already anyway.
Yes. The next page is very much a Kirby action page. Reed is always in motion. The camera is moving around all the time. The first panel gives us a sense of scale. The second panel gives us a feeling of what Reed is going through. And then, wow, that third panel is just too cool.
It is, but I'll tell you, my favorite panel on this page is the fifth one.
Yes.
And followed by the fourth one on the close. I just love how you actually just see the fear in Reed's face. And Reed is not somebody who scares easily.
Right. And also in that fifth panel, again, we're only getting a partial drawing of Reed. The color and the design of the page, because we're not seeing the whole face, that peril seems much bigger.
Yeah, he's being completely enveloped by this other dimension and being pulled towards the subspace Earth. And he's just completely overwhelmed. And that's what this panel just completely depicts. It's Reed is terrified because he has got in over his head, literally.
And one of the things they tell you never to do is to do a 180 perspective from panel to panel. Kirby shows that you can break that rule if you know what you're doing.
Oh, you can break any rule if you know what you're doing. It's just most people think they know what they're doing when they don't, really.
Right. Because panel 3 to panel 4, that camera just flips completely around. But you needed panel 3 to get a sense of the immenseness of the danger. And then we focus in on the personal aspect of it.
But wait a minute. Does it flip around, though? Because it doesn't, actually. What happens is Reed is turning around.
Okay.
You're still...
That works.
You're actually... Yeah. I mean, that's actually what's happening.
The camera's staying in the same place.
The
camera's
in the same position. Reed is now turning around because he realized, uh-oh, I got to pull on my line and get Thing to pull me back. So he turns around and he's pulling on it.
All right, my mistake. The next page, notice how when we did the transition into the soap opera stuff, we had top of the page panel showing what's going on in the main story, and then the lower two-thirds of the page was the soap opera, and then again, the upper two-thirds was the soap opera final panel. In this, we're going from what's happening to Reed is one page, what Ben is doing is the next page. There's no transition panel.
Right, and that actually helps propel the story because it helps explain the urgency of what's going on here.
And it highlights that these are two different universes. Mm-hmm. It highlights the separation. Again, the body language. Especially in the first panel with the Thing, who we've demonstrated previously in this book is unbelievably strong, it's like tug of war. He's pulling with all his might. Sue, that is not one of the things Kirby could do is he could put people in poses that could never work in real life, but they work on the page. No human being would be in that pose, but it works for Sue because we get that sense of worry and urgency and fear.
I'll criticize that one a little bit because it to me it just feels, oh, I got to bend her over enough so we can have dialogue up here. But
now, the problem with that is Stan would add the dialogue later.
Yeah, but you still have to leave room for it. And Kirby has known Stan for years at this point, knows how verbose Stan can be.
The second panel, the Thing's facial expression is just perfect. it's not, oh my gosh, I'm fighting this. It's introspection. It's thinking. Mm-hmm. And Sue is Sue.
Sue is hysterical.
Yes, Sue is the hysterical woman avatar right here.
See, one of the things I love how at the beginning of this issue, we were sitting here talking about how difficult it is to draw facial expressions on thing. And how many times have we gone through this story and said, look, this is a perfect facial expression. He knew exactly how to draw this. You read it exactly. You can see what's going on in Thing's head.
And while Kirby was able to do it so easily, because I've read the Fantastic Four pretty much every issue, except for some of the Paul Ryan, Tom DeFalco stuff, which I don't hate myself enough to read. Even good artists like George Perez had trouble giving the Thing facial expressions.
Well, even Kirby did at times, too. It's just he is on in this issue.
Yep. And again, we show the camera tightening in on the Thing as he's making his decision here. And then when the rope snaps, not only do we get the beautiful pose of, okay, he's fallen back. The rope has snapped. He's fallen back. But again, look at that facial expression.
Mm-hmm. And the motion from, like you're saying, you're going in. This is great storytelling here because you have Thing holding on to the rope. And then you have a close-up of him and Sue, and he's thinking. He's obviously thinking what's going on. You move in closer to a close-up of Thing as he's, you know, contemplating everything. And then it snaps, and it's a full body. As if
yes.
Thing has been pulled back from where we are at. So it just adds that extra bit of motion that I don't know how many times I can say motion and dynamic in regards to Kirby art, but I mean, that's what defines his art.
And one of the things that has always drawn me to Kirby, and it's also what Stan would tell people when he would tell them, draw like Kirby. It's not, you know, have the big, thick shadows. It's not have, you know, the forced perspective. It's make it look like these characters are always moving.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of good illustrators and good artists whose figures look as if they're people in poses. And that doesn't work in comics. In comics, your characters need to look like they're in motion. Even if they're just sitting at a table, they need to look like they're moving. And Kirby was the master of that.
Mm-hmm.
The final two panels is the Thing running to try and catch the cord that is whirling off into the other dimension. Again, more action, more motion. This page is one of those where you might not read all the word balloons because you're being rushed through it.
Exactly. And again, it goes back to the visual storytelling of, you know, between the no transition between read and hear is the urgency of what's going on. It's like, Reed's going to die.
Yep. Yeah. The next page is the Thing being pulled into the other dimension. Again, Kirby goes back to the panel he did with Reed. We don't get a full drawing of the Thing. We get the Kirby crackle around him. We actually get the Kirby crackle on the Thing.
Well, actually, I think there was some Kirby crackle on Reed and the other panel. And I actually, when I look at it on mine, I have the Marvel Masterworks edition. And I don't know if the coloring's exactly the same or not. But you can see some legs. You can see Reed's legs that didn't get completely, that didn't get colored in the pink. Like Reed did here, but here everything of the Thing is colored in pink, and yeah, you have the Kirby crackle on Thing as well.
And then the next panel is him being pulled along as we get a lot of very dramatic Stanley dialogue.
but in making his last-ditch desperate leap after the thin strand of cable.
But also, lucky the body of the thing is strong enough to stand extreme conditions without a protective helmet, or I'd be done for already. Thanks. We didn't need that. But, okay.
I am an asteroid!
One of the things that there's a lot of complaint now that comics are too, you read them too fast.
Mm-hmm.
But when I read stuff from the 60s and 70s where the writer is explaining what is going on the page, it's, yeah, people, you weren't being paid by the word. The art is telling the story. Let it tell the story. We go back to where Reed was, and the thing is being hurtled toward him. And again, on a static image, this looks like it's in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the little things Kirby did was how the cable is looping around as if there's no gravity.
Yes. There's no gravity here, yet it's still, you know, thing is clearly hurling towards Reed at unfathomable speeds. But they're obviously in this weird dimension and in space, and there's no gravity, except for where Reed's standing, but, you know.
Well, different rules of physics. The final two panels, I have always been to the kind of, to me, show sort of the drama in that Reed is very much, oh my god, whereas the thing is resigned.
Isn't that the saddest puppy thing face you've ever seen?
Oh my god, yes. And then that last panel where Reed can't even bear to look at him because he knows the end is coming. And the thing is just kind of, yeah, okay, I guess. I can't believe I was such an asshole.
Yeah, it's these two panels. I mean, even before, when he's going to save Reed, he's like, maybe I shouldn't. Or maybe I shouldn't let Reed die. I'll go save him. And then he does it, and then it's now, in these last two panels, where he's like, oh man, what did I do? This guy's an actual hero, and what am I? I'm just some schmuck. But then when we turn the page, he says,
we're back,
wait,
to dynamic action.
I can be the hero. Now, this right here is when you mentioned Thing walking towards the center of the page, walking left to right, the way you read. This is what I want to talk about. That was a beautiful example of using the way we read to Kirby's advantage. He pulls Reed back to throw him. You know, the way you always do, you have to pull back if you're going to throw. He pulls it back, and that's going left to right, and then he throws Reed, with Reed going again back, you know, right to left. So what's going on here with your eyes when you're looking at these images, you're following it, you're going back, and then you're shooting, your eyes are shooting back towards the right along with Reed. And when you're doing that, you can't help but feel that motion. And I just think that's a brilliant way to convey the motion and to use the way we read in the artwork. It's just fantastic.
And it's one of the things that Kirby had been working in comics for about 25 years at this point. He started late 30s. So let me do the math here. Almost 30 years, really.
Mm-hmm.
He'd never took a single art class, not once. Most of his art training was either on the job or when he was an in-betweener for the Fleischer Studios. He's the guy who drew, you know, the main artist would draw two of the cells for a Popeye cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be the one who would draw the four where there's slight movement to connect those two.
I tell you what, if you want to get into cartooning, there is no better practice at it than being an in-betweener on animation.
And he brought that to comics in a way that so few people. I love John Buscema. I love John Buscema. But John Buscema could never be as dynamic as Jack, because John was classically Brune Hogarth artist.
Mm-hmm.
Jack was all motion and action, because that's how he made his bread and butter when he was learning how to draw.
A lot of great comic artists come out of animation. Jeff Smith is another one I can think of right off the top of my head.
And there are a lot of comic artists who've gone into animation. Alex Toth. Alex Toth did such good stuff. It's almost a gift that we ever got him back in comics.
Mm-hmm.
But probably my favorite figure artist, Dave Stevens. One of the reasons he didn't do many comic books was because he was getting paid so much money by Hanna-Barbera.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, well, if I do a comic, I'm losing money.
Right.
The final three panels where the Thing is resigned to his death. And again, that camera keeps pulling back.
Well, I don't think the camera is pulling back, actually, though. I mean, it pulls back from the first panel, but those final two panels, I think this is a technique that is pretty standard in comics now. It's one I've used in my comics before, and I'm not sure when it became standard or whatnot, but if you look at those last two panels as one image, at least of the background as one image, then the camera is actually staying stationary, and the Thing is actually flying backwards further into the image. Now, you know, maybe it's essentially the same effect if the camera,
right,
if the camera is pulling back, but personally I like to think of it as going the other way, the camera holding still and Thing just zooming on past us, because it feels a little bit more cinematic to me that way. And
okay.
You know, and again, we know Thing is going, we know the rocks are flying away from us. You can tell that by the speed lines on there. So.
And this is also where Stan feels the need to hammer home the core of the story. And it, again, it's almost in opposition to what we're seeing. Because as for me, I'm not going to feel sorry for myself. Not many men get a second chance. But if you look at that first panel in the middle three, that is not a man who's, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm doing it as a hero. This is a man who is resigned to his fate.
Yep. He's like, yeah, I've done it. I wish I could have learned to be a hero before I was going to die.
And again, we see the Kirby technique of, all right, 2/3 of the way through the page, we're going to shift. We're going to move somewhere else to where Ben Grimm is about to go see Alicia. And again, the body language in this is so fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing with the last time we saw him, he was throwing down, ready to fight. And now it's okay. I'm going to go see my girl.
Well, it's not even that. It's like, hey, you know what? I'm not Thing anymore, but I am Ben Grimm. And that's a pretty good thing.
Yep.
He's feeling pretty good about himself now. He's finally human again. It's what he's wanted ever since Fantastic Four issue one, except for when it wasn't when he wanted what he wanted, but you know.
But before he can knock on her door, notice the transformation is done differently here.
Yeah, it's instantaneous here.
And you get the shock of, oh my God, I'm the Thing again.
Now, see, I really, on this panel, I really wish Lee would not have put in, now I can go back and clobber that creep who's posing as me. Because that's not what Thing's face is saying.
No, it's not. Not at all.
And it derails the next panel where Thing is running away, because with that line in there, you kind of think Thing is thinking, oh yeah, I can go back and clobber that guy. But in actuality, he's like, oh crap, I can't let Alicia see me like this.
Yep, I'm a monster again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she just left me for the most perfect man in the world, and I'm a monster. I can't allow her to see me like this. And, of course, we get the star-crossed lover complete angst that Stan ladled on everything, where Alicia loves him, but he's unsure, and we have to have that because we have to have again, two-thirds of the page, we move to another scene.
And here we have Reed flying in from the other dimension, and Sue running up to get him. And again, you know, I can't emphasize enough how dynamic Sue is in that pose when she's running. Reed actually feels a little static to me in this pose, but
yes,
you know.
And the inking does not seem like Sinnott. Again, it's more feathery, it's more light. If you go up to the earlier panels, you see that Sinnott uses a nice thick line.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have a lot of feathery lines. In this panel, Reed is done with very feathery lines. It's not as bold and dynamic. So I wonder if this was one where either, you know, Stan wanted something redrawn or they were behind on deadlines. Because just because you credit somebody with the art,
yeah,
doesn't mean they're the only ones who did it. It could have been an assistant for all we know.
Mm-hmm.
The final page, that top panel. That is such a grief panel. And again, Kirby knows, don't show their faces.
Right. Well, another reason you don't want to show their faces is, at this point, the Fantastic Four are basically movie stars. They all look pretty. Well, no, even Thing looks pretty.
Yes.
And
he does not look like the in the early issues, he looked like a timely Atlas monster. Mm-hmm.
But,
and now he's much more defined.
But everybody in Fantastic Four has a pretty face now, and people's faces do not look pretty when they're grieving.
Right.
And so, yeah, you don't want to draw that, and you don't need to draw that either. You get the message across, you know, without showing their faces here. The body language says it all.
And the reunion panels, in the fourth panel, I love the Thing's expression.
Yes.
I absolutely love that expression. It brings in, one of the things about the Thing is while he was the angst character, he was also used for a lot of the humor.
Yes. And what this panel says to me, and I'm totally right here with you, Ben Grimm, Thing is not a hugger.
No.
And I'm right there with you, Ben. I'm not a hugger either.
One of my favorite lines from Star Trek is from Worf. I do not hug. the bottom three is everything has returned to normal. I hate that final panel.
Oh, so do I.
I hate it. Again, it does not look like a Kirby panel at all.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't look like Kirby drew it. It doesn't.
It doesn't fit the story.
No, it doesn't. And he paid the price. He paid it like a man.
One of the things I want to point out, though, this is very much a twist-ending story, which Kirby did not do a lot of the twist-ending stories. Stan, especially if you look at the work he did with Ditko, was all about the twist-ending short story.
Mm-hmm.
The series Amazing Adult Fantasy was Stan and Jack just doing twist-ending stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the thing that Stan loved the most when he was working on the early stuff, which is why he made it an adult comic book. And it didn't sell all that well because you put adult on a comic book and...
Yeah. It kind of means something else.
Well, back then it didn't have that meaning.
Yeah, but still, I mean, comics were for kids.
Right.
Especially back then.
And a kid would go, oh, adult fantasy, it's not for me. But this feels, the overall plot to me seems very much like Stan was very heavily involved in the plotting of this story because it hits in his wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack brought his dynamic storytelling in a way very different from what Ditko would have done.
Right.
To enhance it. And it's one of the reasons why when I hear that, you know, Jack was the real creative force. No, Stan was the real creative force. No, they were like Lennon and McCartney. The whole was better than the sum of the parts.
Oh, yeah. I'll be honest, I don't really have a horse in the Jack versus Stan fight. What of it there is. I wish with the current crop of Marvel movies out there, I wish Kirby would be getting more recognition and more credit than he does. Acknowledgement for his contribution to the characters in the movies, but you know, that has nothing to do with this.
Right. The wrap up I would like to have with this story is this is a Fantastic Four story at their best.
Yes.
It is about exploration. It is about family. It is about the drama. There's no fight scene in this.
No, there's not. And that's pretty amazing when you have a story all about the thing and not a single punch is thrown.
Marvel was so much about the fight scenes that one of my favorite comics in the 70s, Howard the Duck, had the essay issue where Steve Gerber wrote an essay where, well, it's a Marvel comic, so we have to have a fight scene. So here's a showgirl with her ostrich versus a sentient lamp. There's your fight scene. But Jack and Stan showed that you could have a dynamic superhero story without people punching each other.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you would like to say to wrap up this commentary?
No, I mean, I think we pretty much covered it. It's, again, we're at this point, we're looking at what, in my mind, has always defined this is, you know, Jack Kirby's artwork. I mean, he was just hitting his stride with Marvel here. He and Stan Lee were on fire between the Inhumans, Galactus, this story, bringing in the Black Panther and going back to the Inhumans. You know, there's just a lot of great creative stuff going on in Marvel at this time period. And it's just a lot of fun to read.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. I want to thank you for going over Jack Kirby with me. Why don't you plug the show that you do?
Oh, well, why don't I do that? I am on a podcast with my friends Jen Wicked and Root Bradford. It is called the Comic Bros Podcast. We release about once a month, usually near the end of the month. And, you know, we talk about making comics and reading comics and writing comics and all things comics that we can think of comics.
And how can people find this here podcast?
You can find our podcast at comicbrospodcast.com. We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, any of your favorite social media, although not Instagram. I don't think we're on Instagram. And you can find me specifically at markwiseart.com. I'm also on Facebook and Tumblr and Twitter and all that stuff.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me, and we'll be back soon with more stories. I want to thank Mark for coming on the show. I really enjoyed having him on. And if you're an artist and you'd like to do a commentary on a Kirby issue, go ahead and email me. If you like what I'm doing here, please go ahead, email me, friend me on Facebook, like the page, like the Solitaire Rose radio page, all that stuff. And please get the word out. We're growing. And as we grow, I think it's going to be better for our community. But it's also going to be more fun because the more people who are interacting, I think the show gets better the more interaction we have. So please, just spread the word. That's what I'm asking you to do for 2015, 2016. Listen to the ads, which are right here. Pretty much every form of entertainment has advertising, and this one is no different. Our first ad is for DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best web host in the whole known universe. I've been using them for 14 years. They've always been able to help. They have great services. If you need a web page, they are the best. Just go to DreamHost.com, and if you use the code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. Our second advertiser is Graze.com. Graze.com is healthy snacks delivered right to your door so that when you're at work, you can avoid the vending machine. When you're home, you don't have to reach for the bag of chips. It's dried fruit. It's new ideas. I get it every 2 weeks, but you could get it more often. Great food at a great price. And if you use the reward code CORYS3R5P, your first and fifth boxes are free. That's CORYS3R5P. And if you're listening to this here podcast, you're one of the most good-looking people on the internet. And you don't want to trust your skin to just any old razor, so shave with the amazing razors you get from Dollar Shave Club. Every month, they send a box with your shave supplies at the beginning of the week, or whenever you want. You can pop in a fresh blade and get that fresh blade shave. It feels fantastic, and it's just one of the many ways that you can maintain the good looks that everyone has come to expect from you. That's Dollar Shave Club. If you go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy, it kicks a little back. All of these advertisers, they kick a little back to us, so we can wet our beak a little. We're not asking for much. We're not asking you for money. But if you need these things, go to our advertisers. They support this podcast. Thanks. And we'll be back very soon with more stories.